never cool in school. I'm sure you don't remember me. And now it's been 10 years. I'm still wondering who to be. And I'd love to mix in circles, cliques, and social coteries. That's me. Hand me my nose ring.
Can we be happy?
Show me the mosh pit.
Can we be happy?
We can be happy under.
This is KBOO Portland, and it's 6 p.m., and it's time for the guys to chime in with the name of the show. It's time for The Underground. Say it, guys, there's microphones.
The Underground!
Awesome, good job. The Youth Collective's Public Affairs Show. And today's show is about heritage.
In history.
Thank you. Any thoughts on that before we transition?
Well, our first piece is by Zoe, and I believe she is going to introduce it to us.
Hey, I'm Zoe, and I'm going to talk a little about a little bit about the cat's history.
Domesticated about 5,000 years ago. In Egypt, cats were experts at catching pesky mice and rats in the Nile Valley. Egyptians respected this ability and treated the cats like royalty. When cats died, their human family would not only mummify the cats, but also pluck out their own eyelashes and shave their eyebrows as part of their mourning. Cats were only allowed to be part of a high society Egyptian family, and any lower class family owning a cat would live in fear that their cat would be taken away, or worse, they could lose their own lives for owning a cat. Soon, cats were emerging in North Africa, and in just a few centuries, cats could be found all around the world. Although cats were not treated like royalty all over the world, in places like Rome, cats were highly honored. In fact, a man was once killed for accidentally killing a cat. Cats have changed a lot since their first appearance in Egypt. The original cats were either hairless or your basic black cats, and were treated better than the commoners. Now, in the 21st century, cats come in all sizes and breeds, and are kept in cramped glass cages for the first few months of their lives. One breed that really amazes me is the Maine Coon. The male of this breed can weigh up to 40 pounds, with female weighing up to a third of its male counterpart. The Maine Coon looks like the cross between your common household tabby and a raccoon, and calls Maine its home. These cats are primarily wild, but can be tamed and kept as pets. There are many stories around how the Maine Coon got its name, though no one knows the real story. One theory is that the strange cat came from a fishing vessel docking in Maine. Other theories reach absurd proportions, like that a European short-haired mated with a raccoon. Although I don't know what story to believe, the Maine Coon still remains my favorite type of cat.
We had 13 kittens this year and 17 cats altogether. One of these kittens was part Maine Coon. Now she is 8 months old and weighs more than her mother. I love her with all my heart. Ever since she was born, I've treated her like royalty. The first time I saw her, I crowned her the cutest kitty in the world.
Wow. Well, that was really interesting, Zoe. That was interesting about the Egyptian people and, like, their treatment of cats. Where did you find that out?
Books and internet.
I have a cat. Her name is Penny, and she has more sass than anyone I know. I think that cats, a lot of times, unlike dogs, really don't necessarily need, like, the people that they're living with. Like, dogs are really, like, into companionship, but cats seem to be more of, like, this is my own thing, sort of.
Yeah, cats have an attitude.
Definitely.
I'm allergic to cats.
Aww.
All right, well, our next piece is by Margaret, and she interviewed her friend, and we'll have her talk about it.
Reshna Rashid was born in Iraqi Kurdistan, immigrating to the U.S. with her family when she was 7 or 8. Here she talks about her heritage and how she's adjusted to life in the U.S.
My name is Reshna Rashid, and I am from Kurdistan, which is located in northern Iraq. Kurdistan is not a country yet. We are the largest group of people in the world without an independent state. And Kurdistan is divided up between Iraq, Turkey, Iran, and Syria. And I've been living here in the United States for about 10 years now. And I left my country about 10 years ago. And at that time, I was about 7-8 years old. And I've been living here ever since. I came in 1997.
Okay. And when you were in Kurdistan, is that, like, very autonomous from the rest of Iraq? Is it independent?
No, it's not independent at all, actually. For over many years, this is what we've been trying to fight for, but not in a warlike manner, more of a dialogue form kind of thing.
So as a Kurd, did you feel very different from the rest of the people in Iraq?
Well, I mean, at the time I was very young, so of course I wouldn't feel that much of a difference, especially because in northern Kurdistan it's all Kurds, and you don't get the sense of feeling of difference because it's only Kurds living there, so you feel like you're in a country, but it's not really a country, so it's kind of hard to answer that.
Do you feel offended when people kind of group all of, like, all the people living in Iraq and, I guess, all the people living in the Middle East into one group and don't recognize you as separate people with different ethnic groups?
Well, I don't really feel offended because everyone is limited to a certain amount of knowledge, you know? But when people do call me, like, an Arab or a Persian or a Turk, I try to fix that. I tell them that I'm Kurdish and that this is very different from these other ethnic groups. Although I'm not offended because I don't see anything wrong with these other groups. It's just some people don't know this much. So I try to be, like, patient about it.
When you moved to the U.S., did you expect people to be just, like, accepting you as just another person, or did you expect them to be kind of hostile or anything?
Well, when I was back home, you always hear these stories about how America is the greatest country in the world, and, like, it's a place of heaven, actually. For when I was back in my country, my friends always used to tell me how lucky I am to get this opportunity to go to a country like America. So I was always expecting good things to come from that. And I came here. It was like when I got off the airplane, it was not very different from what I had seen in my country. I thought I would actually walk into this beautiful garden or something, but, like, as far as geography and stuff, that's what I thought it would look like. But as far as the people, I felt very comfortable with them. They were very nice to me, and we had a lot of people help us out here when I came here. I came here, you know, expecting something great, and that's what I got out of it.
Do you feel anyone ever be hostile towards you because of your heritage?
I don't feel it from anyone, actually, to be honest. I don't personally encounter these things because myself, I try to bring myself off as a good person. And I don't think people really judge me based on who I am, or at least how much I know right now. I think people have been pretty nice about this. I haven't encountered any troubles with that, so it's been okay so far.
That's awesome. I'm glad to hear that, because, like, the U.S. doesn't always have the best reputation to being nice to people.
It would make difference if you were to encounter some government official as opposed to your friends or something. But I always do feel a difference myself. Like, when I'm with my friends, I always feel that I'm different in the sense of where I'm from, because most of my friends in school are Americans. So I do feel a sense of dislocation that I try not to feel it, but it's undeniable sometimes, because I know that I'm from a different country and my views are very different from many people, many of my friends. So I try to keep my views, but present them in a way that it won't offend people. So the way I present my ideas and my opinions has a lot to do with how people judge me. And I try to be very respectful to the way I present things, which is why I feel I don't encounter many conflicts with this situation, or people are not as hostile or anything. But I do feel different amongst my friends, because I'm the only Kurd in my school, and most of the people I know are Americans. So I do feel different, but I don't feel bad for being different.
Are there things you do to keep in touch with your Kurdish heritage?
Yes, we celebrate the Kurdish New Year, which is called Nowruz. Every year we have a party, and of course in my household we try to speak Kurdish, and my mom makes traditional Kurdish food at home. But sometimes we go out too. And for Kurdish parties or traditions, we dress up in our Kurdish clothes and do little things like that just to keep it in our lives. I have Kurdish friends as well, so I hang out with them. And I also read a lot of books about my home and just little things like that to help me remember who I am.
When someone asks you where you're from, do you answer Kurdistan or the U.S. or Portland, or how do you address that?
First, I tell them I'm from Iraq, so they know, they can get a idea in their head where the region is, because if I just blurt out Kurdistan, some people might not know, because Kurdistan is, as I said before, is divided up between the four countries of Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria. So if I were to say Kurdistan, they'd have no idea which part of Kurdistan. So I answer Iraq first, and then I tell them, but I'm Kurdish, I'm not an Arab, so to give them an idea. And sometimes people can't even tell the difference between an Arab or a Kurd, but I tell them there's a big difference, not that it's a bad thing, but I tell them, just for their own sake, I tell them these are two different groups of people. And
You have some siblings, right?
Yes.
And they were they born in Iraq or in the U.S.?
My little brother, he was actually born in the U.S. He was born in the Pacific, in Guam, which is in the Pacific Ocean. And he was 7 days old when before we came to Oregon. But we were all born in my country, so.
Do you feel you have a stronger connection to your country than your younger siblings do?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely feel that, especially because I'm much older than them, and I was older when I was born in my country. I was around. I lived there about 7-8 years, so I have some memories tied to my country and my family. And but when we came to the United States, my siblings, who are much younger than I, my other brother, I have two brothers and two sisters, and one of them, who's my older brother, his name is Omar, he was about a year old before we came to the United States, so he had nothing to come here with. And so most of my siblings, when we went back to my country about 2 summers ago, they couldn't recognize anybody. They didn't know who their aunts, uncles, or cousins were. They had an idea from the letters and pictures they sent, but they had no connection to them because they'd never met them before, so, or remembered meeting them before. And it was a lot different for them to go back and they were, for them, it was just like an American going to the country and looking at it from an American perspective, or I should say Western perspective. But for me, it was my roots are deeply embedded in me, and I understand my culture, my religion, and traditions from my culture. So when we were going back, I could connect easier with the land and with the people than if I were them, like one of my siblings.
This was part one of an interview with Vejna Rashid. We will return to the rest after a short break.
Wow, well, I thought that piece is really interesting. I can't imagine what kind of struggle it would be to just come to an entirely new country, especially coming from such a war-torn country.
And America still, I think we sometimes forget, is still like a really young country as far as our history. And so to have somebody come in with such a long line of heritage is also really cool, to have that deep-rooted feeling of history with you in such a, like I said, young country.
Yeah. So that was great. Thanks, Margaret.
We'll be right back. That was by Hassan Basho, Muhammad Ahmed Basho, and Hussein Muhammad Basho. To recap, we have been listening to an interview by Vaishnav Rashid, who was born in northern Iraq, the reason commonly referred to as Iraqi Kurdistan. In this next piece, Regina shares her views on the American invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Do you feel that as a Kurd, you have a different perspective on the war in Iraq than most Americans do?
I would say so, probably, yes.
Would you mind sharing part of that perspective with us?
As much as I'd like to be optimistic, I think it's really hard when you create... When you create a problem, it's hard to fix it. It's much harder to fix a problem than to start it. It's like when you throw a ball into the air, and once it breaks, you can never piece it back together the way it was. You can make it into a ball again, but there's going to be cracks in it, and there's going to be all these little problems to it, but it's still going to be in the same form. And I kind of see it in that sense. In that sense, I mean, myself as a Kurdish person, at first, me and my family, when the war first started, we were kind of optimistic because on one side, we felt that here was our chance to have an autonomous state. But now, the more we look into it, we kind of lose more hope. We're not so hopeful as we were at the beginning. And I mean, myself, I feel really bad for what's going on, as anybody else would. The people there, not only are the Iraqi people, but also the American soldiers there. There's so many people dying, and you feel like when you see these things, you can't help but feel so bad for what's going on. You see all these pictures, all these images. It really affects a person emotionally, and I feel bad for all the damage that has happened to it, and I'm really disappointed that one of the greatest countries in the world, Iraq, is now ruined. So many cities been destroyed, many people died, and right now, when I was living in my country, you know how I told you, it was just Kurdish people there. You would not find any other group of people, such as Arabs or Persians, or it was just Kurdish people. But when I went back 2 summers ago, I was really upset because I saw all these Arab Iraqis like lying in the streets in Kurdistan, many of them without homes. A lot of them fled to Kurdistan because the southern part was all damaged and destroyed, and it was really horrible to see these things, these people suffering in such a way that Iraq didn't have that many homeless people to begin with. You'd barely find anyone like that. And when I went back, it was just, they were everywhere. And that was a really sad thing to see. And it's kind of hard to really say whether this war is a good idea or a bad idea. I mean, it has its good sides and its bad sides. And I don't know what the good sides are really anymore, but all I see is the bad things. And the media also plays a significant role in my interpretation of what's going on. I mean, like everyone else, I'm influenced by the media. But at the same time, I have the advantage of having family there to tell me what's going on from a personal point of view, from what they see, and I can compare that to what's being said on the media. And of course, my family right now, they're pretty upset by it too. They've lost a lot of hope, and they see all these Arabs there, so many in trouble, so many of them are without homes, without food. It's really bad situation for them, and even though we've been victimized by so many of the neighboring countries, at the same time, we still feel so much sympathy for them because we don't believe in this killings and what's going on right now. I mean, as a Kurd, what I want is for peace to be in my country and within the people. And it's my dream for the people of Kurdistan and its neighboring countries to become unified, but that's a really big thing to wish for because so many things, there's just so many problems that won't allow something like that. But, I mean, you can only dream, so that's something I have that I hope for, and I wish that the people would unify instead of do this to themselves. And it's a really complicated thing that's going on, and takes a long time to address, so that's what I have for now.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to an interview with the lovely Regina Rashid, and I am Margaret with the KBOO Youth Collective.
That was a really amazing interview, Margaret. I'm really glad that you had the chance to speak to another youth, especially who is originally from another culture, and get that chance to get her voice on the air.
Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting experience.
So, what's up next, Miss Zoe?
Annie discusses her confusion with her own heritage, discusses how race and heritage are viewed in America today.
My name is Annie, and I am half Japanese, one quarter Irish, and one quarter English, and I am American. Heritage has so many interpretations as it is, and throughout my life I've struggled to understand my own. When I look in the mirror, I don't see myself as being Asian, nor do I see myself as being white. I just see me, the person. I don't really understand the classifications of race as a part of my identity, other than as a description of where my family came from, which I suppose you could call heritage. It's funny, too, to think that for how diverse a society we are in America, that racism is such a prominent issue. It seems as though there is a lot of white guilt in this country, what with programs like Affirmative Action and Reagan's redress of Japanese-American citizens interned in World War II. But despite all this political correctness, there's still quite a lot of racial animosity lingering. Maybe I am not the victim of as much racism as my predecessors were, only because racism has become more subtle these days. But in a way, I think that being in between has become an entirely new racial class. I don't feel as marginalized as I'm sure my grandparents did when they were my age, but I don't really feel included either. Standardized tests like the SAT and college application questionnaires ask you to choose one race as the one you identify with. Choosing just one isn't possible for me. There are such immense cultural differences in the homes of those who are, for example, Asian and half Asian. My two best friends are both half white, and I guess maybe our struggle to identify ourselves is something that we bond over. So what heritage am I supposed to honor? Even my Japanese grandparents were born in the United States, so I am considered Yosei, or fourth generation Japanese American. In Japan, people consider me white, and in America, people consider me Asian. So who really am I? The only thing I know for sure is that I am American. Yet even the term American encompasses so many vast and expansive cultures and traditions. Maybe it doesn't matter who I am. If things continue the way they're going, we'll all eventually be one color anyway. I think that trying to narrow it down is a really bad way of looking at it. America is such a diverse place, and no one race is better than another, and I think that we should all honor and respect one another's heritage and try to learn more about each other's cultures. I think if we want to preserve heritage, we have to uphold cultural traditions, but do away with racial separatism and ethnocentricity. I can't change who I am, and I wouldn't want to, because I understand my heritage and I appreciate it. And I wish that someday we could all live in a world without cultural borders.
So that was Annie discussing her confusion with her own heritage. Thank you.
That was a really great piece.
Yeah, it was too.
I was really glad to see, like, a lot of the time these issues come up, especially with people who, you know, are of one ethnic race but have lived in the United States for their entire lives, for their parents' entire lives, And it's true that a lot of people in America don't see them as, you know, oh, you're just an American. It's like, you're still Japanese, you're still Asian, you're still, you know, Chinese or whatever that person is. So I thought it was really great that you brought that up.
Yeah, thank you.
It was awesome. I like the music.
Thanks. Yeah, that was a Weezer song, El Scorcho. Very good song. All right, up next we have a piece by Brianna, and it has to do with Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King Day is one of only three federal holidays celebrating an individual person. Most agree that King was an amazing liberator and influential speaker, so why did it take nearly 15 years after his death to create a day honoring him? Many states felt that the civil rights movement deserved a day to itself more than Dr. King. Though the holiday was eventually voted into law, it wasn't until 1993 that all 50 states, in some way or another, celebrated the holiday. Martin Luther King Jr. was born January 15, 1929, in Atlanta, Georgia. Due to an absent-minded doctor, Martin spent the early part of his life as Michael Luther King. King never fully graduated high school, but instead began attending universities at the age of 15. In 1955, King emerged from Boston University with his Ph.D. During his lifetime, King was continually politically active, starting the bus boycott that later led to the end of segregated buses and the beginning of equal rights. King was also involved with desegregation, labor laws, and giving blacks the right to vote. Dr. King survived through legal battles and a bombing, but his life came to an end on April 4th of 1968. He was shot while on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. The night before his death, Martin Luther King delivered one of his most heartfelt speeches.
Really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Cats were domesticated about 5,000 years ago. In Egypt, cats were experts at...
Sorry about that, but that was Brianna's piece, and it was about Martin Luther King.
Sure was. I enjoyed it, the much we got to listen to it. It was unfortunately cut off a little bit there. We almost treated to another round of cats, which wouldn't have been too bad, but we got to keep moving. Do you have any thoughts on the piece?
Well, I thought it was really well said. Yeah, it was very good.
Kind of sad. But yeah. If you would like to listen to the complete Mountaintop speech, as well as other recordings of some of his other speeches, check out www.drmartinlutherkingjr.com. With the KBU Youth Collective, that was Brianna Loringer. And next?
Bantu doesn't have a heritage, or so he thinks.
When people talk about heritage, they're talking about something that has to do with someone's ethnicity or religion and traditions associated with that ancestry. I used to consider myself as not having a heritage, though. Being an atheist, I don't take part in the religion the rest of my family practices, and I haven't adopted time-honored family traditions, such as facial hair and pursuing higher education. And as for ethnic group, I wouldn't even know what to call myself. According to Wikipedia, an ethnic group is a human population whose members identify with each other, usually on the basis of a presumed common genealogy or ancestry. So if someone were to put me in an ethnic group, that'd make me either a Caucasian American, a white American, a white person, or a European American. But even though I'm a person who resides in the United States and am the descendant of European immigrants, who cares? That fact doesn't have any significance for me. That's not heritage to me. But Wikipedia also says that ethnic groups can also be united by common cultural, behavioral, linguistic, and ritualistic traits. I had never thought of it that way before. So, if I act and think in a way that is shared among a group of other people, that group can be considered my ethnic group. Any culture can be an ethnicity. My culture is hard to define. Sort of a subset of kids who live together and really love music, playing and listening to it. Kids who maybe go to school part-time and work part-time and enjoy the freedom that having a job brings, and who do it themselves and try to create something new. Some of us love bikes and some of us love burritos, but the differences we have don't get in the way of the things we have in common. Well, anyways, this interpretation of ethnicity is definitely not legally accepted. The Census Bureau basically says that ancestry, ethnic origin, heritage, and roots are all synonyms. But it's still almost kind of a relief to finally have an ethnic group and a way to interpret the term heritage. That was my piece. Buddy, do you have any thoughts on it?
It had good music. I liked the music.
That was the Ramones covering a song called Something to Believe In.
Well, it was good for the piece.
Well, thanks. I liked it too. It's a good piece. Oh, what's next?
It is Mirlo Station High is in Options High School for the Beaverton School District. The school has about 700 students from ages 14 to 21 within their 8 different programs. Merlo Station has Community Day on November 2nd and invited KBOO to make a presentation. The students in Steve Hamilton's class learned how to be reporters by making this piece about Community Day.
The room is dark and very quiet. At first glance, it looks unoccupied. Then you see a ring of bodies lying on their backs on the floor. Very quiet, relaxing music plays. The students look almost to be sleeping until I see Michael look up at me and throw me a thumbs up. This is relaxation techniques in Jim Gardner's 114 room. I guess it's probably not unusual to find people sleeping in Gardner's class, but now they're actively practicing relaxation. It'd probably be pretty rude to start busting in there and trying to interview people. So I think we'll move on.
We stand outside the cafeteria of Merlo Station High School. All the tables are moved aside, and in the middle, a ring of students sit on chairs, beating on white plastic drums. I'm here with Matt Brown. Can you explain a little bit of what this is about?
Yeah, we got Earl here, and Earl works for a group called Ethos, and the whole idea is to create opportunities for people to make music. Most of us are just consumers of music, and very few of us actually make it. So he's out here creating opportunities for people to actually engage in music and make music. You know, at first everyone's all self-conscious. Am I doing this right? And are people looking at me? And do I look like an idiot here? And if you look around, you'll see a few of those people still kind of feeling a little self-conscious, but probably in 20 minutes, they'll all be kind of smiling and loosened up.
We're out here in the middle of a wet, cold field. It's currently not raining, but it could start any minute. We're here to interview some Frisbee players. We're here with Cody Rochelle. What are you actually doing here today?
Just playing Frisbee with other people, just learning new skills with other people, and just trying to have fun.
I'm meeting new people.
Yeah, I met a couple people. It's pretty cool.
I'm Margaret Armstrong. I'm a teacher in community school.
You were here for the Unconscious Prejudice activity. What exactly went on?
Well, based on the book Blink by Malcolm Caldwell, we did an activity called the Implicit Association Test on the computer, where people looked at their subconscious prejudices. We didn't get nearly as much discussion as we'd hoped. We think it was probably because the students didn't know each other as well.
Do you think anyone learned anything?
Oh, I believe they did. I believe they did. I think some students were quite taken with the whole process and were willing to. There are 90 tests on the website, and we'll probably go back and do some of them on their own.
Thank you for being on with us.
Oh, well, thank you.
So what is it exactly that you guys are doing today?
In this session, we're doing what they call team building through active games. It's just an attempt to get different people from different groups in our school to know each other.
And how have they been reacting to this project?
It's really interesting. In the first group, they started off really, really kind of shy and not wanting to really do it. And then by the end of the session, everybody was saying it was really exciting, fun.
We're here with Sing a Song and Sign a Song. They're about to present in Merlo Mic. Are you nervous about presenting?
Nope.
Do you feel that you're very talented?
Yes.
What song will you be singing today?
What a Wonderful World.
All right, can't wait.
Okay, so we're here with Catherine, and what activity are you currently involved in?
I was in the sign languaging act, and now I went to Merlo Mic when I finished.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. I've never done sign language before.
Do you think that you would be interested in keep on learning more about sign language?
Yeah, it would be a nice opportunity to talk about.
Thank you for coming on this interview with us.
So we're here talking to Gretchen Mollers about the Pride Project. So what exactly is the Pride Project?
The Pride Project is sponsored by Washington County Pride, and we have somebody who is leading a session on how to reduce hateful language, especially towards people who are of, like, sexual minorities in schools.
Do you have any hints for anyone who's listening, or not hints, but tips?
If they have, like, hateful language used against them?
Yeah.
There's a couple strategies. It could be like use humor. You're giving that person the completely opposite response than they're looking for. It could be educate them or just shut it down immediately. Those kind of techniques.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're in room 17 with the nutrition group.
My name is Susan.
And how's your experience right now?
Oh, it's wonderful. We've been learning a lot about nutrition and different food groups.
Is this all new to you, or it's some stuff you already knew?
Very familiar. A few new facts.
Your name, sir?
My name is Josh Cecil.
And how's your experience today?
Pretty good. They're feeding us, so that's a plus.
This is what we made.
The cowboy salad has beans, corn, tomatoes, lemon juice, and all that healthy stuff.
I'm here with Marcella Setness. She's leading the nutrition activities here today. Why did you think this was important to educate students today about nutrition?
Well, I think in our current time frame and era, nutrition and health and wellness is a big, important priority for students. We just figured it would be something that they could use in day-to-day nutritional choices, and they could take the knowledge that they learn here and make good choices for themselves.
How are you making this easily applicable to everyday stuff?
Well, emphasizing the importance of eating breakfast to get your body started and your blood sugar level going, looking at nutritional choices that are healthy, discussing the importance of not having a lot of sodium in your diet and the importance of eating calcium-rich foods have been kind of main themes today that we've talked about.
Thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, was Merlot Day.
Well, that was quite the sample plate of radio work. And any of those things could be expanded upon to some kind of larger piece. Some of those reports are really good, and it'd be kind of neat if you get some more kids down here like that.
Yeah, that was cool.
I liked the part where they advised using humor in the face of confrontation. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that it's really cool that KBOO is getting involved in like schools and stuff like that because it's cool.
All right.
And I really liked the piece. It was well reported.
Okay.
All right, Margaret.
Okay, I'm back again with the story my mother told me about her grandmother, Nanny, and a nanny's daughter, Betty Zane, and events that have greatly impacted my family.
I don't know many stories about Betty Zane because she died when she was about 2 years old, so that would have been about 1930, and it was a particularly difficult death. What death of a child isn't, but this had a huge impact on my family, and one that I've only recently begun to understand or to get some more details about. My grandmother and my dad, who was born in 1926, and my grandfather were living in Savannah. So my dad was about 4 or 5, Betty Zane was about 2 or so, and Betty Zane became ill. And you'll have to understand that this is now a couple of years into the Great Depression. And always, before the Depression even the prosperity of the 20s, in the rural South there had been a fairly strong barter economy. It wasn't always cash-based. And now in the Depression era, it was very much a barter economy. People didn't have money to pay for medical visits or drugs, medicines necessarily. They had to trade something that they had of value. You didn't casually go to the doctor. My grandfather worked as a barber. He often cut people's hair for vegetables or whatever they could give him, potatoes. And so when their child became ill, they typically, as people did, tried to treat it themselves. But she had a high fever and got more and more sick, and eventually was so sick, and it appeared to be in such a dire state that somehow they found a doctor who would agree to treat her. I don't know the arrangements, what they offered, promised. Maybe the doctor did it just as a charity case. I'm not sure of the details. There's no way to know now. But what happened was that by the time they got Betty Zane to treatment, she was so ill, and the doctor diagnosed right away that she had diphtheria. And he was unable to save her, and she died. And there, my grandmother was in such dire grief and so distraught, and she wanted her buried in the family cemetery back in South Carolina, and she wanted to be back with her extended family, her sister and brother and her half-sisters. She knew that she would be loved and supported there, and so she said, let's go home, let's bury her there. Well, there was a problem about taking a corpse across state lines, particularly the body of someone who died from an infectious disease, and so they made a clandestine trip. They actually stole the body from the undertaker's facility, the mortuary, and sneaked across the river and drove up Highway 601 and got her back home and buried her, and eventually might have gone back and forth to Savannah a few times, but eventually moved back there, mostly so my grandmother could have this network of support and love and be near Betty Zane's grave. My grandmother had about 100 acres of land she'd inherited from her family, her dad, and so my grandfather undertook farming. He never particularly loved farming. He liked being a barber. He did other odd jobs. He always cut hair on Saturday nights for people and so forth. They made it through, but it was a tough life, and I think partly to handle his distress about this very difficult life of path he'd undertaken of starting to farm in the Depression with really barely enough to live on for so long. My grandfather turned more and more to drink and was, in fact, an alcoholic. Had devastating effects on his family, my dad and my dad's brother. There was another child, third child eventually born. But anyway, it's only recently that I've come to try to piece all this together, and for me that came out of organizing efforts, community organizing efforts that I've done through the auspices of first Portland Organizing Project and now through sort of a successor organization that's active in Portland, MACG, Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good. And in that community organizing, I learned to ask questions about people's paths and history and family and to appreciate story. And I just realized I had this little hole in my own story, or understanding of the story about Betty Zane. And I found out about the trip from Savannah and the secret escape to South Carolina from my dad, who told it when he was 73, 74 maybe, and that was really the first time he'd ever talked about it since he had spent that trip when he was 5 years old, sneaking out of Savannah in the dark of night in the back seat of a car with his little sister's corpse bumping around, sliding around right next to him. It's a gruesome thing, and I see your grimaces to hear it again, but I think he was glad to be able to talk about it after so many years and to have someone ask him the question that brought that story to light. And I think what's been important for me is to understand the struggle with farming and the alcoholism in a bigger light, to understand that it was part of a depression. And it was part of an agriculturally based economy in the South that had become a cash-based economy, that there were so many public dimensions to what was going on that my family kept it all inside and dealt with it by drink and anger or distress. And I want to bring this back around to my grandmother. I got sidetracked with the whole big picture, because for my grandmother, she was probably around 80 or so, or her early 80s, when I tried to talk to her a little bit about Betty Zane, because while I'd always visited Betty Zane's grave and we sometimes put flowers on, we'd never discuss the loss of that child. And she just talked a little bit. She said it was such a devastation for her, because she said, all these years I've had to live with the fact that I killed her. And I said, Nanny, what are you talking about? How can you... What are you saying? And she said, oh, the doctor told me. She said, when it was just him and me in the room with her and she was struggling to breathe and had such a high fever and was really unconscious at that point, he told me, he said, well, you've killed your child. He said, I'm not going to be able to save her. He said, there is an antitoxin for diphtheria, and if you'd gotten her in here in time, I could have treated her and saved her, but it's too late, and so you're just going to have to accept the fact that you've killed her through this neglect of bringing her in. And at the time, I hadn't heard all the story that my father shared with me later, I just tried to offer some love and sympathy, but it devastated me that she really, at that point, still believed it was her fault and that I may have gone to her death believing that. She lived to be 87. She died when you were a year old, as you know. And I guess I like telling this story to you occasionally. It's a very difficult story to say and to hear said, but I want you to remember that there are public aspects to these private stories, and that to understand how this lack of cash was not just an individual family failing, but part of a depression that was bigger than all of us.
Do you feel that by better understanding your grandmother's and your father's story, that you can better understand your own story and your life?
Well, yes. If nothing else, I mean, I was aware as a child there was something going on with my grandfather. I mean, I look back now and see that there were the periods when he was drinking and drunk and then recovering from this. And I was protected from it as much as possible. I just knew he was sick, is the way it was said. It's helped me understand some of his crisis of what he was trying to deal with by handling it all privately and internally. To blame himself, to try to understand his wife's grief. He deeply loved her, and his own loss. I mean, I've talked about my grandmother's grief and devastation, but I need to acknowledge his, too. It's also helped me understand my father. One of the things that's happened over the generations I know about, from my great-grandfather to this grandfather I've been discussing to my dad, and down to me even, has been a mitigation of anger and temper that I have seen over the generations, that's improved. And I believe that coincides with more an increasing ability within our family society to acknowledge the bigger picture, to talk about it, to try to bring things public that might have been kept private, to share a little bit more. And that's helped me to share this with you.
So do you think by sharing this with the public, you're making another step in reconciliation within your family and stuff like that?
I don't know about reconciliation. I don't know how my family would feel to hear this on the air, I guess I'm doing it selfishly for you and for me, and I'm setting aside the fact that other people are hearing it. I don't know how this will go. But I guess... what I'm hoping is it will encourage people to ask questions of their older generations, to take the time to sit as many times as necessary to build up that trust, to share some stories and feelings that tend to get tucked away and that children are usually protected from, often for good reason, but that we can begin to understand as adults.
As is a youth radio show, what do you think the young people of today cannot take from the story you're telling us?
Stop and think about why the adults in your life are as weird as we are. Find out these stories that they're tucked away. Maybe they're carrying some things they'd like to tell you that they've never had a chance to talk about. And you can give them that gift by being patient, asking questions, looking past the cultural divides that are often amplified by the media and used to separate generations.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
That was my mother telling me a major piece of my family history and talking about the importance of understanding the context of one's family stories.
All right. Thanks, Margaret. Thanks for listening to The Underground. The Underground is hosted every fourth Wednesday by the KBOO Youth Collective. We meet every Wednesday at KBOO at 6 p.m. to plan our show. If you're interested in getting involved, come on down or call our youth advocate, Aaron Yankee, at 503-231-8032, extension 511, or email her at kbooyouth@hotmail.com. We also do a music show, Youth Randomonium, the last Friday of every month from 11 to midnight, and we're always looking for new music by anyone under 21 of any style. Check out our website at kbooyouth.org. The first and third Wednesdays of the month, Circle A Radio airs at this time, and the second Wednesday of the month, Hole in the Bucket, a public affairs show on homelessness, airs from 6 to 7. Next up is DJ Audio with Nonstop Hip Hop. I'm Annie, and thanks for listening.